I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone, hope you're well. Thank you for tuning into the podcast again. Today I am joined by two guests, which is the first time I've ever had two people in the studio before, so this will be interesting. But today I'm in with Colophon. Is that how you pronounce it, by the way?
Yeah.
It is, right. Good. So Anthony and Ed. Just to give everyone a bit of an introduction, Colophon are is an international award-winning type foundry based in London and Los Angeles. They were founded in 2009 by Ed Harrington and Anthony Sherritt.
Yep.
God, I'm good at the pronunciation
today.
Task themselves with creating and publishing and distributing high-quality retail and custom typefaces for analog and digital media. Since then, they've worked for a huge roster of clients, spanning from practically the whole alphabet, from Coke to Google through to GQ and Rafa. They've also worked in collaboration with top-flight studios, including Sagmeister and Walsh, Wieden and Kennedy and Wolf Ollins, among others. Basically, they've absolutely dominated the creative landscape, and it's a pleasure to have them on the show. So, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having us.
I firstly just wanted to mention a bit of the tedious link about how I come into contact with you guys. So I worked with Tom Baird. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
Yep. So Tom was the copywriter to me being the art director at Wieden's. And then he introduced me to Jack Benson, and I went and did filmmaking with Jack, who introduced me to Connor. And then Connor mentioned you guys. And it seemed like whatever was in the water at your uni, everyone seems to be doing really great stuff. So where did you actually study and what was your experiences like there?
So it's a bit of a funny story. So we, both myself and Anthony, met at Brighton University, and we started in 2006, which does seem like quite a long time ago now. But we started then and we had kind of quite different friendship circles. And then in the second year, we were walking back to kind of wherever we were going, and I mentioned that I wanted to go to Japan, and 2 weeks later we'd decided that we were going to go, and we were in Japan with no kind of real plan, which is a recurring kind of theme. And as we went through this trip, and during that time on this holiday, we decided that we'd kind of, it would be quite fun to start a design studio or work together a bit more. So after that, Anthony left in the second year, which I'm sure you'll talk about in a moment. But I graduated just in 2009, and graduated off the BA graphic design course. And then we kind of started up the design studio while I was still in university, and then started the Type Foundry shortly thereafter in the April.
What's interesting to me is that, you know, Jack Benson's kind of filmmaker, musician, Connor did history, I believe. So was it drinking and clubbing, or like how did you guys all meet?
So Connor is actually a really good friend. Oh, well, he's the brother of my really good friend, Matt. And that's how I know him. So I grew up with Connor back up in the Fens. And I also know, so I kind of knew him through there. And then it was once he started kind of learning to code and doing development work that we actually got acquainted a bit more and started working together tentatively. He actually kind of, he shared a studio space with us. He rented a desk from us for, I think, about 6 months in 2013 or 2014.
Yeah. So where is your studio based?
We're in Hackney Downs, okay. So just north of Shoreditch. So.
Oh, wicked. So before I get into this, and just to explain, like, I've broken this down into the process of type and also the business side, which is what particularly interests me, but I'm sure there's loads of type buffs out there that really want more info.
Want the juice.
Yeah, that's it. But I thought if we could just start, could you explain a little bit the difference between a font and a typeface, and you're talking about font families, just so that when we're having this conversation, people aren't getting lost.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to get this right, but a font is the like container of the design. So a font, it used to be like a particular size, so it could be the set at certain point size in metal type, for example, and now it is kind of referred to as like the software that the design contains. And a typeface is the actual design of the set of characters itself. So there, that's the differentiation between the two.
Right. Okay. So I always thought, so this is, it hits my naivety of being a designer already, but I always thought a typeface contained multiple families. But is that incorrect?
It kind of does, yeah. So you can have multiple faces within a typeface, I guess. You can have lots of different designs. So you can have a regular, you can have a bold, you can have an italic. And that can span from just a single face all the way through to, lots and lots. So like up to maybe like 70 or so. It really depends on what the designer is trying to accomplish with the design.
So, question for both of you, why type and why? How did that love develop?
I think it was like so when we started the studio, we had no clients at all. And, you know, we kind of you're sitting there, kind of we sent out like, we both put in a bit of money and sent out a mailer to clients, and like graphic design was quite slow. So we kind of discussed doing self-commissioned work to a point, and both worked out that we'd drawn typefaces independently through our university days and before. And, you know, it was quite a small scene. It was a very contained scene at that point. Like, the software was still quite wasn't as kind of like democratic as it is now. And I think we really were. It felt like a good vehicle for self-commissioned work, and it felt like a very something that we could kind of grasp onto and put out ourselves. So we released three typefaces when we launched the Foundry, and then kind of went from there. Really, it was like, you know, something I think that we both understood was very important in graphic design, and just kind of like amplified what we were doing at the time. And I think also the way we approached it in quite a specific way. So I do all of the graphic design work, and Ed is much more a sort of technical sort of side of things, settling on the type design. So that splitting of tasks was very important.
No, so could you explain that a little bit more? So you graphic design as in, yeah, traditional graphic design.
Traditional graphic design, like branding, right. Print design, book design.
Okay.
So when we started the business, obviously we wanted to kind of have the biggest offer of service as possible. So we actually like folded an A4 sheet in half and wrote down tasks on each side. And it got kind of stupid. It was like tea, the other side, coffee. It's like, you ring the doorbell, you say the words. Like, you know, kind of like very like basic. But I think in terms of actually how we approach things now, it's something that's kept with us, because it's that understanding of like, if you do one thing, you're very, very limited in your income stream.
Sure.
And if you spread yourselves wider, then you have much more of a chance of staying afloat. Keeping in mind, we started the business on the worst day of the crash.
Right.
So we were kind of up against it from day one. So we had to actually try and think kind of in a very sort of, you know,
Of all the things people could need at that moment in time, a fresh typeface isn't the one.
Okay, you know, yeah, but I think we kind of the market was actually like a lot smaller, and I think we really it was like a good. I think the approach was the right thing to do in that time.
One thing I was going to ask is, I imagine that you've got your type development process pretty down to a T by now. And so I thought, could you maybe explain like what that process is, and also how it's changed from when you started, and, mm-hmm. and what mistakes did you guys make, and how have you, you know, changed things?
Yeah, I guess it actually hasn't changed that much over the years. It's more just become a bit more developed and refined. So we've always started with, again, coming back to that idea of splitting tasks. So when we got a design commission, for example, we would design a typeface for it. That's purely out of the fact that we've only ever used our own typefaces with our design work. And that was by necessity as well, because we didn't want to buy and couldn't afford other licenses. So we actually just decided to use our own tools. And this kind of gave us a platform to design something new. So rather than picking a typeface and kind of shoehorning it to the design and going, oh, this is quite good, but maybe not quite right. By creating something new, we were able to tailor something exactly to what we needed, both in terms of a concept, the requirements, like the weights, for example, and style of it. And we've done that pretty much from day one. We've kind of worked on projects, and this like type process has become, we'll start off very, very quickly with just a few characters, for example, in a rough direction, and then it will progressively get more and more expanded. So we'll draw more characters, maybe more weights, more styles, more language support, and depending on what's required.
I was going to say, so it's very, very rare that when you start a design project that you've got enough time to design a font to go with it, let alone different weights for, you know, different call to actions and ligatures and all the rest of it. Like that's a luxury to have.
Yeah,
it was a real just kind of what we could have time for there and then. So a lot of the time, you know, I might design a certain amount of characters and then give it to Anthony, who would then just start designing, and then go, actually, this would work really well. So I'd be able to then react off that very quickly, and there wouldn't be this formal design process where you're having to like review and do everything like that. It was very much a very reactive process and very quick. So we'd quickly develop these typefaces that would be very, very rudimentary in their construction, but would be quite good just to give the client an idea of what the design was trying to convey. And then over the time of the design, while that's kind of going on, I was then able to refine these designs and then kind of resupply Anthony with these font files, and then that would kind of take a new life into the project as well. And so it'd be a very step-by-step process. It wasn't kind of all at once right at the beginning. It was very much what we see. It's kind of like a table tennis match where it's back and forth all the way through. And that's kind of started right at the very beginning, and it still happens now with our projects.
So could you name your three favourite projects to date? And what I'll do is I'll link these up, so for anyone that's listening online, they can check them out.
That's really difficult.
For me, one of the most recent, one of my favourite projects we've worked on is the typeface for Wales. And we were commissioned by a Cardiff-based and Dutch half and half studio called Smorgasbord, and they commissioned us to create a typeface for the country Wales. We created a typeface called Cymru Sans, and that was really interesting because we were able to work in lots of different languages now, like as our kind of fonts have grown, you know, from all the way from Latin-based languages through to Cyrillic, Greek and Thai. But this was interesting because it's Welsh. It's so close to home, but it's quite alien as well. And we were able to kind of explore the Welsh language in a way that hasn't really been done before. Like they use what's called digraphs, which are two characters which make a particular sound. So a CH character is used as a single kind of character in their alphabet. And we treated them as independent characters that were used in this font specifically. And I think that's probably my favourite project recently because it enabled us to really kind of explore something that we were very unattuned with, and I think most people are in terms of the Welsh language. I thought that was quite interesting.
I think probably I'll work for Google in terms of, so we worked with Google last year they relaunched Google Fonts, the open source platform, and they commissioned us to create a type family, and it was quite free reign, kind of follow your own path, but obviously with certain like kind of sections of feedback. So we worked with Benjamin Critton over in LA, and it was really like interesting because we were able to like look at, obviously being self-driven, we were able to look at like what Google is. It's a software company. What do you write software in? You write software in monospace typefaces. So it, normally for us...
Sorry, can I interject? What's a monospace typeface?
A monospace typeface is a typeface. So the letter doesn't have to be the same width, but if you imagine every single letter is in a box, so there are lots of boxes stacked on each on top of each other, you have a container to design within.
Right.
So they're normally used for data, annual reports, numerical figures, kind of things that need to align vertically and horizontally. So you coded them, so it enables like quick reading of code, basically. So we looked, normally when we design a type family, which is kind of extensive, they're more of a bolt-on. So they sort of, you know, we'll design the proportional side of the family, so like, you know, regular italic, bold, etc. The mono will be like kind of not an afterthought, but like a stab on. So we decided to look at it as more of a kind of contained unit, being for Google and somehow inherently connected to software. And then from that, we started to like kind of look at really dystopian and utopian references. So sort of Back to the Future, Blade Runner, Matrix, kind of things that have uses of type in terminal-based context. So by terminal-based context, I mean like screens where they're coding or...
Minority Report.
Yeah, exactly. there's always like a certain aesthetic.
Yeah.
So we sort of like start to call these moments in as like this kind of... Google is this like kind of like weird dystopian, like, dare I say it, monster. In a good way. But... Yeah, so it's like just a really interesting approach to be self-driven, and they were like super supportive of it. So we designed like a four-cut family, two kind of upright variants of the mono and italic as well, and then produced a book for them as well. And it was just like a really interesting commission because it felt because it's such like high profile, but we were really allowed to kind of research and like used old references and old sketches we produced back in a few years before, and really kind of get into it. And it felt like kind of a bit of a dream commission. And then to have someone like that behind you to support what you're doing is normally
amazing. You think with a big brand that you're going to hit loads of levels of hierarchy and everything, but you basically were given free rein.
They were super supportive the whole way through the process. Yeah, it's one of my... And also the idea of being open source is just, like, really interesting for us. You know, this idea of, like, giving the tool away and it kind of having a life of its own.
I'm going to come to that because I've got some really interesting questions
okay,
and that
right.
kind of stuff. But so you've worked with numerous studios, and I was curious to know who your favourite collaborations are to date. And just also, out of my own curiosity, I wanted to know what it was like to work with Sagmeister and Walsh, just because I, you know, someone that I've admired... growing up in the design community.
That was fun. Like, we worked with Zaping, who's now left. So we worked on like the Jewish Museum identity in New York, so they use Apisu for their identity. What we actually did wasn't ever used, I don't think. So we did like a bespoke cut of Apisu for them. It was like kind of like a really fun... I can't remember. It was like four years ago now.
Yeah, it was a bit more of like a development process to see what was and wasn't possible. And in the end, they decided actually they'd just use Apisu rather than the modified variant. Yeah. But I think it was for them to explore the possibilities of what can and can't be possible. Mm. So what sometimes we find with clients is that they'll have an idea with maybe some type, and they'll go, oh yeah, let's like change it to this, and it can look really great, but then sometimes in practice it can become overdone and it can grab too much attention, so you have to kind of rein it back. And I think that was probably what happened in this project. But it was a nice process to kind of work with them to explore the possibilities of what could be done. And they ended up using our typeface Apisu for the secondary typeface or the primary typeface for the Jewish Museum out in New York.
I just think it's amazing you got your work everywhere. It must be so exciting. But so I couldn't ask, talking about having to rein it in and stuff, do you prescribe to the belief that kind of type should be invisible to some degree?
Definitely. I think to some degree, I think it's very much based on context. I think you kind of look at editorial work, and I think, you know, there has a very big place in having expression to kind of communicate what the content is. But I think a lot of the time actually type is that, you know, if you know, I have friends who are not related to design at all, and you know, we always call it like that, like, you know, our parents, if they're like talking about the typeface, something's wrong. There's some kind of invisibility, however, no matter how expressive, you know, if the type is visible, then somehow, or like so visible that someone who isn't connected to design is talking about it, then it's somehow wrong. And I think that's really interesting challenge that we have
especially when you're trying to sell these things, right? And so you need something to latch onto, like what's different about this?
Think that kind of landscape's changed in the last few years, because a lot of large companies now understand that the kind of value of owning assets, especially is in terms of IP. And I think many years ago it wasn't heard of. And I think that also that landscape has changed in terms of, so I'm kind of going off a bit subject here, but in terms of smaller companies and smaller studios working with larger clients, I think maybe 10 years ago that was unheard of. Whereas now that's becoming more and more prevalent. And I think that's a really positive thing, that kind of smaller outfits are able to work with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 man teams rather than larger studios.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's just nice that all of a sudden there's money trickling down to people that are doing things that they want to do, right? And you know, making the industry more invigorated and interesting. When I was at uni, I know you guys kind of started out when you were at uni, so I just designed a display font called Suave, right? Mm-hmm. If you downloaded it, you'd cringe. It's probably horrendous, but so it was actually quite successful when it went like through Behance and everything. And I put it out for free at first, and one day I received an email from a friend of mine saying, "Rick, I think your font's been used on Paris Hilton's album cover."
Right? How did you feel?
Oh God, it was. So I googled it, and then what I saw was a picture of her face 6 times on the front cover. It's called Good Times, right?
Okay.
So,
were you having a good time?
I was. So, her face 6 times around my font in the middle with the like garish pink and purple like colors like running through it, and I was just like, oh man, it was supposed to be like a sophisticated 1920s art deco typeface. Anyway, I was curious to know, obviously I'm sure you guys have seen your font pop up all over the place. What are some of the best and worst use cases of your font?
It's
always a funny one, because we get asked this a lot, and it is always quite interesting, because we do get to see them in some amazing places and some truly awful places as well. But I think it is always quite interesting, because you never know, like when you release a typeface, you never know like how it's going to do and like what it's going to be used for. You know, like we've had, I think only like one typeface where we've designed it for a specific reason is actually got used for that. And I think pretty much everyone who designs fonts, that will be the case for. But in terms of best and worst, best, there's too many to mention. I think there's it's very subjective. But I think not worst, but funniest was we were doing a talk in Norway, and we'd travelled over there, and we got off the plane and then went past the equivalent of Spa out in Norway, and they were using one of our typefaces to sell hot dogs, but they'd like added on loads of bevel effects and drop shadows and just made it the most insane thing you've ever seen. I just thought that was absolutely brilliant because it was so out of context for what other people at the time had been using it for. They'd been using it for like nice art books, very subtle ways, and then there was this like garish sign in like 10 different colours, and it was just amazing. And I just thought it was
did you get a snap of it?
I did, yeah, yeah.
Wicked. So again, we'll include that, we'll link it up. There's various movement, I call them movements, but so say skating in the 90s or weddings or whatever. Basically, you've got these areas of interest and there tends to be an associated typeface to, yeah, or typefaces in and around it. Like, what areas do you see where you would either like to redesign it or kind of reclaim it and you'd like to design some type for it?
That's really difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of did one of those. So we, five years ago now, we designed a typeface for a primary school. The idea being that we would replace Comic Sans. And that's always like a super interesting one because Comic Sans is obviously has this like hatred, especially in terms of designers. But it's actually like really well done. Technically, like you can't really pick it apart, but it's just like something that has been drawn out of context so many times that it becomes like a bad smell.
Yeah.
But actually, it's like,
well, it was based on comics, right?
So yeah. It fits. Like, yeah, it fits really well. That was really interesting. So I think like that kind of ticks like a huge box for us, and that was actually like a really interesting journey because, as Ed said, like in the previous question, it's the only context, I think, where our font's been used very specifically in that way. So, like, other primary schools, they're using it in, like, maths books for primary schools. So, that you know, all of the uses are relational to the initial design idea. But in terms of future, I'm not sure. Something on, like, a plane,
big
transport mode.
Yeah, like, that'd be interesting.
Modes of transport would be great. Anything. So things that move.
Yeah, things that move. That'd be a good one. Steal American Airways. It's moved on from Massimo Vignelli stuff,
yeah,
hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they changed it, didn't they? Because it was like one of the longest lasting logos, I think.
I have to ask, before I move on to business related questions, do you ever wake up in the morning and think, if I have to stare at another letter, I might jump off a bridge?
Yeah, that happens quite a lot. I mean, not quite that dramatic. But
jump off a wall.
But, yeah, obviously, like, our projects can... Sometimes they can be very quick, and we can design something that will be out of the door within a week. And they're great, because they keep us kind of active and on our toes. But other things, especially our releases, they can take anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. And if something's been in the studio for kind of 3 years, you really start to resent it. And you're like, okay, I'm kind of really done with this. And it makes it very difficult to make any big changes, obviously, because obviously the bigger the change, it amplifies and filters down to every small thing. And so you have to be very certain and be able to carry this through for a long period of time. And this can become quite difficult when you've got to take your time through the whole process and you've got to really like believe in it the whole way through. So yeah, by the end of it, it can be quite difficult by the end where you're like, okay, I just really want to finish this now. And we've always tried to, whenever we've released something and got it out the door, we've tried to never really go back and revise it too much. It's always been like, oh, it's out there. And it's kind of got to live its own life. But yeah, generally it can become a bit of a labour of love with something kind of staying in the studio for so long.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I'm glad that you're human and not robots, which is... no, I love it. I love type. Like, all I do is just love crafting letter O's and or S's. S's seem to be particularly difficult, I find.
Oh, yeah, massively.
What's your worst or letter or favourite?
I think favourites are like a cap R, or actually I do quite enjoy doing the cap S, but just because they're quite interesting characters, they've got more going on than, like, a cap H, for example. But the most problematic character I find is either a cap or a lowercase x. Because they look really simple, but like to get them really balanced and working actually really well is quite difficult.
So what letters do you start off with when you're designing stuff? Isn't there like a supposed formula for where you should start?
Yeah, I mean, there is. Everyone has their own different approach to it, but what we usually say, and when we kind of run workshops or teach, we usually say to start with a capital H and a capital O, because from an H you can then break that down, and if you think of it as components and shapes, you can then quickly make lots of other characters very, very quickly. So from an H you can make an E, F, T, L, and an I. So once you've got those, then from an O, you can then combine that and you can make a D, you can make kind of like a C, you can make a G, a U. You can make lots of, from using this, like the same kind of design principles, maybe not exactly the same parts, but like the motions that you're using, like the weighting or the contrast or the overall colour, you're able to create this tool set that will quickly design a lot of characters for yourself, and you'll soon find you're like kind of like 15 characters in before really actually adding any defining features to your kind of typeface.
How do you go about, sorry, I wanted to move on from this, but these have just come to me. So like, how do you go about defining weights? Do you guys, so in the past when my amateur approach is I just design the size of the font that looks good, and then I start stroking it and cutting away at the type in order to get the rough levels I'd like it to be, and then...
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's pretty much not far different from what our approach is. You know, we'll add bits on, take bits off, and chop and change it how we need to and refine these individual weights. We usually design the lightest and the boldest weights, so then you can kind of interplay into the middle and kind of hypothesize these. Sometimes you'll have to design the middle weight as well to kind of really fine tune this as well. But yeah, it's kind of just working out what you need and what you need it for and what you need it to achieve as well. So if you're designing a text face, that will go through lots of iterations to make sure that it runs well in body copy and in certain sizes. So it really depends on what the typeface, what you're designing it for as well.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So moving on to the business side of it, which is the side I always find way more interesting personally.
But
so you've already mentioned that you started this kind of straight out of uni, basically. And you were fairly young, and I was curious to know, like, so you said that when you were on holiday that you wanted to get this started, but did it start in a bedroom? Like, how did, like, what were the first steps about establishing this?
So I quit university in the second year, and I worked out of my bedroom for 6 or 7 months freelancing. Kind of got to a point with it where it's quite an isolated affair and felt that I needed a workspace. So I jumped in and kind of rented a fairly cheap workspace and kind of worked out where I met some fun people that kind of inspired me to keep doing things, I guess. And so when we kind of came up with the idea of starting something together, Ed moved into that space. By that, I just mean like putting his computer next to mine. no grand affair. And yeah, so it's like just very like ground up. We invested enough money to print like a kind of A3 fold down. I got 500 printed, I think, two color, and then sent those out to, I don't know, 500 or 600 yeah. people. And then we managed to get like 2 or 3 jobs, meetings, and we did like a month worth of meetings, I think. And then we got like 3 or 4 jobs, 2 or 3 jobs, something like that. And kind of went from there, really.
So who was the first? Who can lay the stake in the ground?
First ever job was a studio mate, Jake, commissioned us to do his website. So we did that. That was really fun. Then we did an art map, Deptford art map, and a gallery identity, just like small jobs.
So when was the tipping point when you thought, you know what, this could potentially work?
Probably not for like a year and a half later. Like the first Christmas, like winter out of university, was pretty dire. We were in a, like a large studio space, and the whole of the back wall was like basically windows, single pane. And this was like the 2009, so we had like a really bad snow that year. And it got so cold in the studio that we had to turn the fans off in our computers because they were like getting too cold because the movement of air, so try and heat them up. And we basically like ran out of money in the January. We came, because obviously, like, you know, obviously now we understand how business year works. You know, people get budgets at certain times, people go on holiday, so they just don't commission work and money stops moving around. So we basically went on holiday like completely like depleted from like not having any commissions, running out of money, etc. And then came back in January and we're like, okay, what exactly are we going to do here? And we got this like someone who'd seen like a bit of our work go out from the council, rang up and like gave us this job that just like, literally like saved us. And then from there we just managed to use it, and it was like enough money to kind of like pay a couple of months rent, bit of food money, etc., etc. So from there we kind of like slowly built on it, and then by then we'd got enough of a kind of I guess like name to kind of really.
This was going to be my question to you guys. So you were young when you started, and you've worked with some pretty big names, Google, blah blah blah. You know, was ever, especially with something like type, which is quite a technical thing that's going to be used on a lot of things, did youth ever come into it? Did where people met you and were like, guys, like, can you actually do this?
I mean, I know this is obviously audio and you can't see this, but we look quite young, or fairly, well, maybe not now because I look tired because I've worked. But,
so how old are you guys?
30.
Right.
And we started when we were 21, nearly 22. So we look quite young, and I think it always felt a lot of, at the beginning, a lot of meetings were kind of like, well, these guys are really young, should we trust them? And obviously this is still, I feel like it was like business, you know, it wasn't, you know, it's quite a long time ago now. It wasn't the point when everyone was setting up their own studio. This was very much like you went to work for a studio for 10 years and then you might set up. Now, you know, nowadays it's not unheard of that you'd come out of university and maybe try and start a business. I think back then it was very much like unheard of, or people were like, you know, really? Like, I remember Hamish, who we work with now on Typefaces, but he releases through us, but also is Ed's tutor.
Hamish
McGill.
Right.
he kind of said like, oh, like, you know, you're gonna set up a studio. It's like, really? Like, and then like, he said like they're kind of teaming up, and like I said, oh, I'm gonna work with Ed, and he's like, oh no, I understand that will kind of work from the kind of the differentiation between the two of you. So it was really like a, I don't know, not an unheard of thing, but it wasn't like.
So who like were there clients that said, like, yes, vetoed you on the basis, or did you always manage to get over those hurdles?
I know. I think most of the time we were vetoed, actually, like 60% of the time.
Really?
I mean, people are like tough. Like, you know, they don't want to listen to a couple of little kids in a room. You know, like, why should, I mean, being frank, like, why should they trust us?
Yeah.
But I mean, a few people did, and on reflect, we actually like worked super hard for them. And I think that's the thing. Like, and at that kind of level of interaction with the client very early on, I think it was actually like invaluable, because you understand like why people commission you, why people trust in you, and then you kind of, maybe not knowingly, but you change what you offer. You change how you represent yourself.
Talking about not wanting to have two young kids in the room, like, obviously I'm sure you went through some hurdles in order to get to where you are today. Like, mm-hmm. What were some of the biggest fuck-ups you made in the early days?
So we printed a... you know exactly what I'm going to say. Yeah. We printed a leaf... Well, it was like an A2 fold-down poster thing. And the printer, I won't name the printer, but like they fucked it up pretty hard. And we complained. And in our naivety... We thought there was enough fuck up that they maybe didn't want to get paid. So we just like kind of like spent the money elsewhere. And then like the invoice must have been lost in the post. And we just got it like 4 months later, like a demand. But like, shit, we don't have this money. So we just had to pay it. And I think it was like our last couple hundred quid.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like there's been so many like silly, we were kind of like, I mean, like, we did a lot of travelling when we were young as well, to, like, doing lectures. I don't know how we winged it, but we did a lot of lectures. And we were kind of, like, kid-like, you know, just running around, like, causing chaos and, like...
Yeah,
a little bit, you know? Like, we were just a bit, like... We had fun. It was great, but that was now. This is now.
But if that's your worst mess up, but like, so was that for a client, that folder?
That was a client, yeah.
So how did you get over the hurdle of having to explain to them that they cocked it up? Did you go to another printer, or?
I think for the client, it probably wasn't that visible, but for us, it was, because obviously you don't have, you know, when you have such, you don't have that much work, you know, everything, there's so much more pressure on every single thing. So when it came back and it was like, definitely wrong, it was like, oh, this is really annoying. And, you know, it's like the wrong paper, but, you know, the client, like, you know, yeah, they're like, it's still paper.
Yeah, like, client gets a local brochures and goes, oh, I love this.
Yeah, this is great printing.
Yeah. I just did something for a friend of a friend recently, mm-hmm. and it's going to go in like a local little book, do you know what I mean? I sent them something that took me 5 minutes. Like, I love it. Yeah. I was like, right, okay.
So everyone's this happy.
I wish. So how big is your team nowadays? And the other, to tie into that, like, how did the LA office come about?
So there's five of us in London at the moment, which is like, so there's three people who we work with, and obviously myself and Ed. So we're at this like weird point where it's actually like, we were discussing this the other day, how it's like somehow now scary that there's more people who work for us than there are us, which is this weird tipping point. Someone said to me, like, if you can't get your team around one table, get scared, it sounds about right, I think. But like, obviously, you know, we still can, but there might be a point in the future when we can't. And then LA is Benjamin Critton. So Ben actually came over and did a, internship with us back in 2010. So obviously, like, over the internet, you don't really know who people are, so he applied. We were like, yeah, come over, hang out. He turned up and he's like, yep, I'm older than you. So we're like, this is no longer an internship. And then we sort of like dawned as this like collaboration, and we got on super well. He went back and he was living in New York at the time, and just kind of started working together organically. Like, things came in and We did an exhibition out in LA. He was when he was still living in New York in 2011 for Toyota. And he flew out and we just had like great time together. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew. And it's like one of those things of like convenience as well as make sense. He has a different, completely different standpoint to us on things and approach. So like sometimes there's projects, certain projects that just make complete sense to get someone in to just really drive it in a different way.
I'm sure kind of, especially hearing your story about how you started this straight out of university, it's quite inspiring for young people that are just like, do you know what? Fuck it, I don't want to go and work for a big corporate monster. And I want it on my own terms and to design the stuff that I want to design. But obviously there's a flip side to that, which is that you're running a business and that comes with its own problems and hurdles and headaches.
For sure.
And I just wanted, you know, honest for people listening, like what are some of the things that you wish you didn't have to deal with?
Money.
Emails.
People. Oh, no, it's all kind of enjoyable to a point. It's just like, it's like anything, you know, there's this sticky situations that you have to learn, I think, and that's kind of fine. You sort of grow with it, and as long as you're willing to like grow, develop with it and understand what your role is. You know, like recently, like now there's five of us, Ed and myself, our roles are changing. We do less work, you know, we're directing people, we're working with people, and like we're not there doing the work as much as we used to be. We still do, but we don't do it as much as we used to. But that's kind of like amazing to like, you know, like work with people and like they're probably gonna be listening to this, but like you know, build up together what we're doing, like together as a team. That is like really enjoyable process, and I wouldn't change it actually. I think, you know, me and Ed and myself always said that, you know, by being two people, there's only so much you can do. There's only so many ideas you have together. So you have to add more numbers to make more ideas and to do different things and to grow your business. And I think it's actually been one of the most rewarding things I think I've ever done is work with different people, as challenging as it is.
Yeah, I think whenever we've brought someone else into the team and into the fold, it's changed the way not only we work, but how our company is run. They always bring different skill sets and a different approach to things, as Anthony was saying, and that enables us to do different jobs or do jobs better. You pretty much like 9 times out of 10, like we're able to actually do something that would not have been possible had it just been us two or us three, or like, you know, once we're kind of building and we're able to kind of bring in these different skill sets, that we're able to kind of do something very, very different for the same kind of jobs. And that enables us to keep the approach and the output very fresh and unique as well. Because what we're very aware of is we don't want to keep doing the same thing over and over. And bringing other people in allows us to do different things. You know, if someone has a different background to us, we're able to then like go, right, okay, what do you want to do? And then we can accommodate that and get involved with this and maybe be able to take on certain different types of projects as well.
I think also it's like there's certain people working with us now, like we both said we see ourselves in them because they're obviously younger than us, so it's like we see ourselves in them, which is like super exciting, because you know, you don't get like jaded, but you just get like,
yeah,
I've done this for a while.
You get jaded,
yeah. But it's like, yeah, it's still great, but it's like, that's great, like that's really, I don't know, that's like something that you want to like build people and help them and see them like do amazing things. And we've had interns in the past that have gone on to like have brilliant jobs and like working with other interns in, you know, they never met and they're suddenly at the same company working together, or they're doing like, they're running this amazing campaign, or like you working with them. And it's like, that's like seriously rewarding. It's somehow like some, you know, like flying the nest or something like really abstract way. You're just kind of, you know, like building upon people. And like for me personally, that's something I learned at like Hort when I worked in Germany, and like that kind of idea of like mentoring and trying to like give back. You know, it's not all like taking, it's like giving in some sort of abstract form. And like, hopefully, you know, like the people that currently work with us and before feel that they got something from us. And, you know, it's like a, an exchange of levels, you know?
Sure. Moving on ever so slightly, going back to kind of the work versus your type foundry. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know, you mentioned assets earlier. So, you know, there's a whole landscape within marketing around passive income.
Yeah.
And to me, it seems like type is one of the very few areas where when you actually generate something, it genuinely does passively earn you revenue, or mm-hmm. It certainly has for me on the one typeface I've designed anyway. Yeah. And, you know, the upkeep for it is relatively minimal.
Tiny,
if it's successful. So two questions here. Number one, why, like, with a client project, I try and explain this to people who don't really understand it, that, like, you know, you get a client project, it's great, but then as soon as it's done, it's like, there's nothing else there. And so you get, a chunk of cash, but it's not building upon what it is you're trying to generate, versus if you create a typeface and it may earn you less in the short term, but obviously it lives.
Stretched, yeah.
And so why do you continue to do client work, number one? And secondly, is there a kind of a bit of a Pareto principle with regards to your typeface, i.e. are there a handful that make all your money?
And, definitely.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of like just a three-pronged approach. I think in this day and age, you would be... I mean, I think we all know, like, the kind of project-based work is tiring and... A lot of work, basically. You know, like you said, like you do when you continue, which is like fine, but like where it's just perpetual, basically. Whereas I think the way we try to approach it is we have the project based work, which obviously is that model, but we also have the product, so they take pressure off each other. And if you can kind of balance those things, as you know, like the same business, if one of those is slightly down, the other one's slightly up, or if they're both up, you're in double winnings here. And I think it's just like the further we've gone along with working together, the more business minded we're becoming about it. And actually, like, now people say, like, you know, what do you do? Like, I'm a director. I don't say I'm a designer. It's just like, for me, it's like a mentality of like, so design, you know, I love designing still, and I like applying what we do day in day, but it's like, I think it's, for me, it's really interesting to run a business as well.
If you're talking about it from a business perspective, then sure, like, being that you've got a great reputation and a cult-like following among type fanatics, would you not just concentrate on generating fonts?
So there is a valid case for that, but also as well, when you're just designing just fonts for commercial release, you can kind of come against this blank paper syndrome. You know, like, if someone says design a font to any type designer in the world, they'll all go, what? Like, they won't understand what to do. You know, like, you can't just create something out of nothing. Yeah. And so a lot of our, like, you know, like, we need an excuse or a reason to create something, and a lot of these can't stem from smaller commissions, like a lot more design commissions. But in terms of the client side of projects, these are actually now, more so recently, they're becoming not only just a day in day out project, but they're also becoming projects that are actually challenging us and pushing us further and pushing our capabilities further. So we're doing a lot more kind of different languages. We're doing a typeface at the moment that is to be used in the Thai language. And this is something that, you know, if someone said that even like a couple of years ago, I would have gone, like, no way, like, we could never do this. And now we're able to kind of add this to our kind of repertoire and be able to offer this to other clients and be able to work with, build up a network of different people that we're able to consult with. And this constant challenging in the client side of things, if you're just doing one or the other, you wouldn't have this balance. And I think you need a certain degree of both in order to push them both forwards, or one of them forwards. You know, you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over, because it will become very stale and stagnant. You need to be able to change the direction you're going in many times, even though it still looks like you're going kind of in the in one way, you're able to explore different possibilities. It might not be that they all turn out successful, but at least you kind of gave it a go and worked out what was and wasn't possible.
I think it's also kind of supply and demand. It's like that kind of thing where, like, if you're an artist, I'm not saying we're, you know, artists, but like same principle, or even kind of companies, if you, like fashion is like, if you make 600, you know, all of your collections for 10 years across 1 year, then you probably won't get as many sales if you did over 10 years. It's similar principle. It's like, we, you know, it's better to do maybe slightly less and keep the demand up and the supply low than just keep hammering stuff out.
So you're
out.
Trying to be Burberry rather than...
Yeah, definitely.
Primark.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's also like there's a limit, like, you know, like type is connected to fashion somehow, or like taste, zeitgeist. And I think if you just release stuff, you kind of become flavour of the month maybe for 6 months and people are like,
So I'm curious to know, like, with regards to a client project, how do you decide how much you're going to charge? Because obviously when you're doing it, it's probably for a reason, but then the scope extends. Do you like license the font to them for a duration of time, or do you keep the intellectual property rights, or do you just sell it? Or
depends what the premise of the commission is and who it is. I think if the clients come to us for a bespoke typeface, we would probably push them to, if they were happy to pay enough, sign IP over. Because it makes sense business-wise.
Yeah, and usually when someone wants something very specific, it is exactly that. It's specific for them. You know, if a client requests something and they go, right, we want it to be based, say, for example, off our logo, you know, there's no point in us retaining the IP to then sell that, because no one wants a font that is based off of company A's logo, you know, like,
as we spoke about earlier. Yeah. Font ends up all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, of course.
Devalues can... what they're doing somehow.
Yeah.
But generally, I think, especially more recently, a lot more companies are just seeing it as maybe, yeah, like something that they can buy and then own. And, you know, otherwise, because they could just go out and buy a typeface, you know, and license that for whatever uses they need. But usually if they're going for a type commission and, you know, going the bespoke route, they usually want it solely for them, you know, otherwise kind of what's the point? So if they're able to tailor it exactly for them, so usually it's exclusively the IP is transferred over.
Okay, great. I think that's... Oh, I've got one more question for you, which is, how do you currently market your fonts?
Abstractly.
Yeah.
I don't know. We don't really have, like, a marketing...
Team.
There's five of us.
You just go on the quality of the work sells itself.
I mean, we have, like, ideas that I think we want to project to different clients. But I don't think we never like hard sell. I don't know. It's, for us, it's worked this way that we just kind of made stuff and things luckily sold, which is like a beautiful.
So, like, I'm sure for you, like, so, like, to, like, how much is a full family, for example?
Depends how many cuts. So, like, regular italic bold. It's about 400 ish.
So, at £400 online,
yeah,
there's probably quite a. You could do a lot of exposure with £400 if you're only after
buy a lot of Primark for £400.
If you're only after one sale, I mean, like, you know, you could probably find a funnel that could achieve one type sale for £400 or considerably less. Something worth exploring. I'd recommend it. if you can pump £200 into you know, spreading your amazing work without being too hard sell and make a sale out of it,
yeah,
then surely you're just pouring more money in the top. And
I
know it's not about that when you're a creative and it's an artistic endeavor, but
I think we're more like, I don't know, just kind of like,
you want it to be a bit more organic and, yeah, not too much, as you say, like the hard sell and it being kind of rammed down people's throats. I think it has to be an or this kind of natural filtering of like it being out there, but then there does still have to be a certain degree of marketing. I think it's always like a difficult... People have very, very different approaches to this across what we do. Yeah. And we find it really interesting to see what other people are doing in terms of like how they market their things and what they do and what they don't. And various things work for one person and won't work for another. And I think there's lots of different approaches. I don't think there's a right and wrong. It depends on who you are and who you're approaching to and who your kind of target audience is. But yeah, I think there's still something we're still
developing. Just off the top of my head, I'm thinking like, you know, if you know that one of your typeface works particularly well for a certain time of year because of the style, mm-hmm. style of it, well, you could literally just float an image, no sales around it, just like, look at this beautiful type we make. Saturate the market around the time of that event, mm-hmm. and off the back of it, you know, someone's going to see it and say, that's the kind of font I need for my project. Saying this kind of stuff takes away the whole wall of allure around like being a artistic.
I think it's like there's like certain foundries that do it like very directly, which I have no problem with. But for us, I think it's more, we're not more interested in people buying into like more of an idea of what we want to achieve, maybe. And like, because I'm totally not against like marketing. There's no such thing as like selling out in graphic design, in my opinion. It's just like, you know, if you can have the most commercial value for doing something you believe in, then you win. So it's, I don't really have, I think it's more like, I think like, it's just like advertising, like a very like, this is the letters, buy this font. It feels like very dirty somehow. And I think it's like, it's better when it's more like abstracted.
So you said, you just mentioned kind of briefly there on your vision. So what is the mission for you guys?
For the next like 10 years?
Yeah, I'm just kidding, like, you know, what's, you've done everything, right?
Well, I mean, no, I think there's still a lot of ground we haven't covered, and I think there's still lots of jobs that we'd like to approach. And we've been very lucky over the last few years to work on some amazing projects and work with some amazing people, more importantly. And I think definitely to expand upon that, and probably to expand our team to get these different opportunities to work on different types of projects. So we've always found that the most interesting projects are the ones that we've ever done are the ones that scare us, and where we kind of come out of the meeting and go, oh boy, we can't do that. You know, like we're a bit on edge going, you know, is this really possible? And, you know, because we believe in what we do, and we work forwards to kind of accomplish that. And I think that they're the more, in terms of in the future, I think we want to kind of take on more of those that put us in those kind of sticky situations where you go, right, can we or can't we do this? And like, how do we accomplish this goal, and how do we fix this problem? So I think that's kind of...
I think also like maybe apply... Well, this might surprise some people. Apply what we've learned outside graphic design and type design as like two people working together. I think what we've realised, especially in the last year, is that actually like the formula isn't just about type design, it's about applying that elsewhere. This is not in the short term, but I think in longer term, I think we'll probably like spread the net wider and try and encompass different disciplines or activities. And I think that's healthy, because you can't, it's hard to, it's like kind of people changing jobs, you know, like no one really like, you know, our parents' generation, they would stay in the same job for 20 years and that's kind of normal. Whereas like these days people kind of move around like constantly. And I think it's the same premise. It's like, okay, well, we've worked for like some of the biggest companies in the world now. Well, how else can we like push this in different directions? And I think that excites me, because it's, first, it's scary. Secondly, it's just like something I haven't experienced before, and like, you know, we'll meet different people and we'll have different experiences that I wouldn't have thought we could have.
Exciting times.
Exactly, yeah.
So before I ask you the final question, I can quickly fire some quick fires at you. Mm-hmm. So favourite typeface at the moment?
Oh,
no. Metica.
At the moment, or in...
Well, or favourite typeface of all...
Can I come back to that one when
okay,
I think
sure.
about it?
Terrible answer.
Some of the typographers you admire.
Renner.
Caslon at the moment. Looking into his really old stuff, obviously. But the original drawings of that is amazing and kind of very intrigued.
Any modern day ones? Let's give some folks some credit for their...
The guys at Line 2, guys at Grilly.
Yeah, the guys at Commercial Type as well. They're doing some amazing stuff. They're like pretty much a lot of our contemporaries are doing some lovely
sure.
stuff.
If you could redesign any logo, which logo would you redesign?
It's got to be a bad one, isn't it? Because, or like oh, not a know, bad one because all the good ones.
Are these going to be like one word answers?
Well, whatever you want.
Nike? I don't know.
That'd be an interesting one. To try and yeah.
Oh, I don't know. British Airways.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Actually, it's terrible. Sorry.
There you go.
There goes my points.
So favourite books that either you personally like or that you'd recommend to people?
Oh, okay. This is actually genuinely a very difficult question because we have a ginormous book collection at our studio and we've kind of stopped buying books recently because it's just got a little bit ridiculous and we keep forgetting books that we own. However, a book that still resonates with me quite a lot is not even really type design, but it's TDR, which is the Designers Republic / Idea magazine special from like back in like 2003 or something. And it's this incredible book that showcases all of their work in the most elaborate way possible. And it's I managed to get a copy, get hold of a copy, and it's absolutely stunning. It's in like this like cardboard slipcase and it's just like one of the most beautiful over-the-top books I've ever had the pleasure of looking through. So
probably like Artist's Ephemera. It was this exhibition in America. I can't remember what museum it was, and it's just basically like ephemera designed by artists. So obviously at the beginning of their careers they do like all the invites for exhibitions, so there's like this weird juxtaposition between kind of like an artist who does a one-off piece making something that's a multiple, and it's like the most bizarre but incredible book. Kind of like design's a bit dicey, but the content's like incredible, like really really fun. So yeah,
good suggestions. Favorite movies?
Ooh,
I feel like saying like oh no, that's tough.
That is difficult.
Paddington.
There's
I don't know, aesthetically, like something like Requiem for a Dream.
I was literally just talking about that in the office. I was showing the drug scene.
As a mate, like, I mean, it's like, don't ever watch that if you have a few drinks. But it's aesthetically, it's a brilliant. I did some work for Darren a few years after he did that, and like, still like super, like for Wrestler and Fountain, and just like both just very like aesthetically driven, succinct films, like incredible. Very different to what we do, but just like have big kudos.
I think Apocalypse Now, it's still a film that's just amazing. I just think there's so many parts of it that are just absolutely brilliant, and Marlon Brando is absolutely brilliant in it. So yeah, I just absolutely love the film. So yeah.
This was something I was going to ask you before and I failed to do so. Is there something that we can steal of your work, or maybe it's a typeface or something that we can give away to the listeners? Like
Space Mono. It's for free.
Yeah,
Google Fonts,
right?
Yeah, that's that is completely. It's quite interesting because this was the only project that we've given away all of our source material as well. So
yeah, you can see everything we did.
All right. Well, I tell you what. I'll link that up for anyone that wants to download that. Or
you can download it. You can use it online via Google Fonts. Fuck! I feel like I'm selling it.
You can make.
Like,
you can
not allowed to sell.
It.
It's all about the soft sell. Remember? So,
yeah, but yeah, no. It's. I think that's like a. Yeah, that's super, like just write letters to your mum or something in that. All right. That'd be cool.
Wicked. So, final question. Where can people get hold of you, number one, if they want to reach out?
You can ring. I quite like when we get phone calls.
Yeah.
It's better to ring than email. Mm. Email is just like...
Where can people find your number, though?
On our website.
Yeah?
I can say it now.
Okay, go for it. Go on.
020 3095 1782.
1782. 97. 9782. Yep. There you go.
Yeah.
Get phone in, folks. And then last question. If you could give the world one piece of advice to help them live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
Keep at it, I think. Just don't listen to anyone who says you can't do it and just keep going and believe in what you're doing.
I don't know, just do it. I mean,
so you're going to change the logo, but keep the tagline.
This is the full rebrand. Yeah. Strategic direction.
Right. It was lovely to meet you guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks
really
so much for having
it.
Us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Reese Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.